Good morning, everyone. The Senate Education Committee will come to order. Today's Thursday, March 5, 2015. It's 8:30 a.m. We're in room 107 at the State Capitol. We have several bills before us today, and based on authors that may be present and other scheduling accommodations, we'll mix the agenda accordingly. Senator Stumpf is not able to be here today. He's at a funeral. I'm a co-author on Senate File 1248 for computer science credits, and we'll take that first. Testifiers are here for that. You're rewarded for your punctuality. So I'll put the gavel to Senator Johnson and go to 1248.
Get a few more testifiers, I think. I hope they're all four.
Senator Wieger for Senator Stumpf, the bill, Senate File 1248.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1248 would allow a computer science course credit to fulfill math credit requirements. And this is done in response to the growing need, recognition of the importance of STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, and the relevance of a computer science course, particularly how it's going to help one be better prepared for post-secondary, for career. And the idea actually spawned by Jim Russell, who's here, and it was his idea, suggesting it to a legislator, and that's why we're here today. And so I'd like to ask, as my first testifier, Jim Russell, who's a principal field applications engineer for Microchip, to give a little background as to why he feels it's important, and then we have a representative from the Minnesota Tech Association. So,
Mr. Russell.
Mr. Russell, state your name.
Thank you for your time. My name is Jim Russell. I'm a resident of Plymouth, Minnesota. So throughout the course of this testimony, I'll be quoting some statistics. These statistics come from an organization called Code.org. It was founded in 2013. Led by executives from Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and others. It's funded by Facebook, the Walt Disney Company, Mark Cuban, Amazon.com, Bill Gates, Steve Ballmer, many others. So while I did not personally compile these statistics, I do trust their credibility. On October 25th, 2014, my representative, Sarah Anderson, rang my doorbell on her campaign trail, and I talked extensively with her about what had been on my mind since my son Keith was born 2 years ago. What's been on my mind is we have a major skill gap between today's employer needs and employee candidate education in computer science. I've been worried about my son's public education opportunities since my wife and I found out we were going to have our first child. Today I'm doubly worried as our second son is due to arrive 2 weeks from today. Since Representative Anderson knocked on my door this past October, she authored a bill allowing computer science to fulfill a math credit, and I testified for that bill at the House Education Innovation Committee on February 24th. And here I am today with the same concerns and passion. Minnesota is one of 25 states that does not allow math or science credit for computer science classes in high school. Nationwide, less than 1% of all advanced placement enrollment is in computer science. Now, if you focus just on STEM-related AP courses, computer science represents only 2% of the total enrolled, despite 60% of STEM jobs having a computer science bias. These computer science jobs pay 75% more than the national median salary. Today, there are fewer computer science majors in college than there were 10 years ago. So why is that? These are confusing and conflicting statistics. So why is the education engine not turning out more computer science students? Broken? I don't feel that it is. I feel it's just behaving exactly how the education engine was designed. The problem with the design is marginalized incentivization. A simple promise of a high-paying job just isn't enough for a high school student to enroll in a difficult computer science class as an elective when their short-term goal is to graduate with a high enough GPA to get into the college that they desire. A marginal elective credit for a difficult class is not enough incentive for a student to risk a low grade. My high school experience was different. I asked for and received early computer science training through the math department at Pequot Lakes High School up in northern Minnesota. After graduating with a degree in electrical engineering from the University of Minnesota, and now some 20 years later, my career provides me the opportunity to meet with engineering management and executives across the country, across the world, and across many different vertical markets. One of their most common stated challenges, no matter what the market, no matter what the company, is the struggle to hire qualified software engineers. So these things, I think everybody has one, they're not magic. These kinds of devices are deliberately designed and created by talented electrical and software engineers. Very successful firms, like this one, develop these kinds of things, and they have work to do. And this work will get done, and it will get done here, or it will get done somewhere else. Today, a lot of that work gets done in Asia and Eastern Europe. We ought not force our children here in Minnesota to actively reach out for computer science education. It should not only simply be made accessible to them. Proper credit should be given for these kids' effort to learn this high-demand skill. So thank you for your time. I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. And I believe we'll hear from the other testifier and then open for questions. Mr. Dukic.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic. I work at the Minnesota High Tech Association. And just a little background on the Minnesota High Tech Association. We represent more than 300 science and technology companies from across the state with the goal of helping Minnesota become a top five technology state. And a key piece of that is STEM workforce and education. So we hear from employers all the time about the demand for people with IT skills, you know, not to mention the 21st century learning skills and business acumen. And depending on which figures you reference and how you define STEM jobs, we will need anywhere from just under 80,000 to 180,000 workers in Minnesota in the STEM fields by 2020. And overall, we anticipate a 13.5% increase in Minnesota's IT employment by 2019. It should be noted, however, that most of these projections do not capture the impact of STEM in an increasing number of industries like agriculture and education. STEM-trained employees are also sought by fields such as finance and business operations. So, you know, STEM permeates not just the direct field of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, but also related fields. So currently, the leading tech industry sector in Minnesota is computer systems design, which in 2014 employed 32,700 people in Minnesota. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics notes that the top computer or IT-related occupations will include some knowledge of or a degree in computer science. And just for a flavor of what these titles include, such as computer programmer, IT systems analyst, and software engineer. And as our other testifier noted, folks in the STEM fields earn significantly more than those employed in non-STEM fields. We have the average STEM wage of $77,800 compared to $43,460 in the non-STEM fields. So STEM education and workforce development is crucial to helping Minnesota fill the demand for STEM positions while improving the financial outlook for families across the state. And allowing computer science courses to fulfill Minnesota's high school math graduation requirement is one way to encourage more students to take computer science at a younger age and build the skills they need to fill our future demand and current demand, in fact, in this area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dukic. The testifiers have certainly made a case. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to offer the A2 amendment. This is an amendment that I discussed with Senator Stumpf, and he is in agreement. And I think especially Mr. Dukic would appreciate this one. And basically, it allows courses that are offered through the Project Lead the Way program that could also be cross-credited for mathematics and science credit. Project Lead the Way is a national program, and it is based on STEM courses, engineering, biomedical technology, and this would also fulfill the intent of Senator Stump's bill. And so, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A2.
Any questions for Senator Clausen from the committee members?
Madam Chair, as a surrogate here today for Senator Stump, I would respectfully say that's a friendly amendment and support it.
Okay, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment by Senator Clausen? You did make the motion, Senator Clausen, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Clausen, I'm familiar with Project Lead the Way, a great program. What I'm wondering is it specific, or are there other programs that schools may adopt that are similar to Project Lead the Way where maybe we'd want to be more broad in our description?
Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I believe there are programs out there. I'm very familiar with Project Lead the Way from previous work that I've done with that organization, and I know that the cross-crediting issue is something that in Minnesota we've been working on for Project Lead the Way, looking at the standards, making sure that they are consistent with the academic standards in science and mathematics. So I can't speak for other programs. I can just speak for firsthand knowledge with Project Lead the Way.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Wigger, did you have a comment?
Did we act on the amendment?
Not yet. Okay. We're ready to vote. Yep. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted.
Madam Chair, that completes our testimony. We'd open for further
questions?
Comments or testimony.
Committee members, any questions for our testifiers or for Senator Wigger? Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wigger, I just a comment more than a question. I really supportive of this change. I think it's really important that we start to encourage schools to look at computer science courses, especially. I had the benefit of computer science courses when I was in high school and took them when I was taking my electrical engineering degree coursework at the university. And even if you don't major in computer science, I think that familiarity with the ability to code or come up with programs, I think the logic sort of process that you go through is really helpful in a lot of areas. So I think it's not it may seem narrow, but I think that kids can benefit even if they don't end up going into a computer science program as such. So I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Wicklund.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I want to thank Mr. Russell for answering the door when someone, you know, we know how it is when you're knocking on doors and not all the time, and someone's going to actually come out and talk. And I appreciate the receptivity that you had and from your state representative. And that's how the process works. So
yeah, it was
at its best.
It was great. We talked for probably 20 minutes on my front step about this. It was real grassroots.
Very good. And as an engineer, we salute that as well, and congratulate you for being an advocate. We wish you the best as well with the arrival of your new child in a couple of weeks. And his wife wanted to be here. She was in a minor car accident. She's okay. But we wanted to have it a family get together. But perhaps at a future time we can celebrate this. So, Madam Chair, I would ask that
Senator Wigger.
Senate File 1248 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Any questions from members? Otherwise, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? No. Motion carries. I'll tell Mr. Russell, the bills don't go this easy all the time, so you've done good work.
Yeah, before us, Senate File 1185, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to move, I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And members, the A1 amendment is language that came from the work between myself and some folks from Education Minnesota. There was some concern over the particular language with regard to the effectiveness categories and trying to sort of identify that at the state level. We decided that just referring to the improvement process under the teacher evaluation subdivision and statute was a compromise that was worth doing in light of the fact that there's a lot of districts that have locally developed frameworks as outlined in the law. And I think this still gets at what we're trying to do. So that's what the A1 amendment does. And then, Mr. Chair, I'd also – so I'll move the A1 amendment first, and then I have an oral amendment.
On the A1, author's amendment, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Adopted. And the oral amendment.
So the other amendment is an amendment to the effectiveness date. And I, frankly, am not sure why the bill was drafted with a 17-18 effectiveness date. That wasn't my intention, and there doesn't seem to be any objection. I spoke with the folks involved. So I'm going to just amend on line 1.21, get rid of 2017-2018, and change that to 2015-2016.
Does everyone have that? Delete 7 to 5, 8 to 6 for the 2015-2016 year. Senator Clausen on that oral amendment.
No, Mr. Chair. I was just scratching.
Okay. Thank you. You got my attention. On that, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Motion adopted. We have Senate File 1185 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a fairly brief bill, as you can see. Basically, Senate File 1185 looks to serve the interests of both student teachers as well as existing more senior teachers in the classroom. The clinical experience that student teachers get in the classroom is important. It's an important springboard for their success as a teacher moving forward, and we simply feel that it's in their best interest to place them with a teacher who doesn't have some of their own work to do with regard to their own performance. And it also serves the interest of that more senior teacher who absolutely will want to work through the improvement process themselves without having to worry about taking on a mentorship or anything of that nature. The bill is really in that spirit, members. There is no punitive element to this bill. It's simply trying to place young teachers in an opportunity for them to be successful. So with that, I'll turn it over to the testifiers we have here. So.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. And for testifiers, as you know, state your name, who you're representing for our tape.
Great. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joshua Crossan, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm with the Minnesota Campaign for Achievement Now, or MinCAN, and we're in full support of SF 1185. Senate File 1185 would build a basic definition of who is to be a cooperating teacher. A cooperating teacher would need to have at least 3 years of experience and be at least, according to the amended bill, not in the improvement process. So this would give new teachers an opportunity to find their bearings before taking on a student teacher. And it would also give more seasoned teachers who are just frankly not ready to take on a student teacher the flexibility to focus on their own professional development rather than somebody else's. The idea for this legislation comes from five distinct places. One comes from a report from the National Council on Teacher Quality, which analyzed and defined areas to improve Minnesota's teacher preparation laws. The lack of standards for cooperating teachers was a blatant area for improvement here in Minnesota. Number two comes from a report and poll titled From Good to Great, which asked our national and state teachers of the year what experiences and supports most contributed to the growth and excellence of you as educators. By an overwhelming majority, they agreed that a high-quality clinical experience was among the most important pre-service supports they received. And when asked what made their clinical experience of such high quality, they pointed nearly unanimously to their placement with a great cooperating teacher. Number three, a paper from researchers at Stanford, UVA, and SUNY that found first-year teachers were more effective if they attended preparation programs that, among other things, required student teachers to be placed with cooperating teachers of at least 3 years of experience. Number four, from our Minnesota educators and student teachers. When you mention the need to improve the quality of the clinical experience in a room of educators, I can guarantee you that you'll hear dramatic differences in their clinical experiences. Teachers have told us time and time again that they have been partnered with substitute teachers, first-year teachers, and teachers who really should have been focusing on their own professional development. And to that point, I would like to hand out a letter. It was signed unanimously because, like many student teachers, this gentleman has to find a job after his experience and wants to keep up good relationships with his colleagues. But this student teacher is currently a teacher at Hamline University. He was in his clinical experience, was placed with a first-year teacher, then asked to be placed with another teacher with more experience, so they placed him with a second-year teacher. Still not enough experience. Actually, that was switched. He was placed with a second-year teacher first and then a first-year teacher secondly. So it wasn't until his third placement where he was placed with an experienced, seasoned teacher who can give him the foundation that he needed to develop into a new teacher. This teacher should, and it's noted in this letter, this teacher should have been focusing on his own development and not figuring out where he's going to be placed. So I really encourage you guys to look at that letter as well. And lastly, the general public. According to a recent poll, 80% of Minnesotans support placing a student teacher with an effective cooperating teacher as determined by their teacher development education evaluation plan. So this body passed laws, and we'll hear more legislation attempting to answer the question, how do we increase the amount of time a future teacher should first be a teacher, or be a student teacher, sorry. I believe the more fundamental question is, how can we ensure that the clinical experience is a quality one? And MNCAM believes that SF 1185 is a great first step towards ensuring high-quality clinical experiences. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Holly Craigthorpe, and I'm a Minneapolis Public Schools teacher. Currently, I'm on a leave of absence doing advocacy work. I'm a 14-year veteran teacher, and prior to taking a leave of absence, I was the union steward at my school. I'm also the parent of two elementary school-age children. Currently, I'm serving as an advocacy fellow for Educators for Excellence, which is a teacher-led organization that works to locally elevate the teaching profession and bring voices like mine to the policy table. I'm here today to speak on behalf of our 1,000 members at Educators for Excellence and also to share a little bit about my personal experience with student teaching. So our members at Educators for Excellence select issues that matter to them by becoming part of policy teams who research these issues and make policy recommendations. I'm here today in support of Senate File 1185 because this legislation would support our recommendations for increasing teacher diversity in Minnesota. And I'd also like to thank Senator Brandon Peterson for the A1 amendment. We know that strong teacher preparation and the induction process are both critically important to increasing teacher diversity and to retaining teachers in general. The most frequently cited reasons that new teachers leave the profession are, one, a lack of support, two, the wrong types of support, or three, not feeling effective. And I feel like a positive student teaching experience coupled with supportive induction and mentoring can effectively set the stage on each of these fronts. Additionally, our members advocate for longer residency models, which I believe we will hear a proposal today from Senator Claussen on such a model, and that these types of models make the role of the cooperating teacher even more important. Let me talk now about my own student teaching experience. I was fortunate to have a wonderful student teaching experience, and I actually didn't know how lucky I was until I contrasted my experience with some of the peers in my teacher preparation program. My cooperating teacher was Terry Keir, a U.S. history teacher at Washburn High School in Minneapolis, and he demonstrated some quality key competencies that contributed to my success. One was he had a strong content knowledge. He was also successful with students from diverse backgrounds, and he had a culturally competent mindset. So he had the strong ability to teach. Also, he had a strong ability to mentor people like me. He motivated me to seek a teaching job in MPS, where he continued to informally mentor me, support me. Even after he retired, he volunteered in my classroom, and he was an incredible resource for me. I can confidently say that I would not have spent 14 years teaching in Minneapolis if it weren't for my cooperating teacher, Terry Keir. But some of my peers in my teacher prep program were not so fortunate. Stories like the ones that Josh Crossan just shared, there were too many of those where it was clear that some cooperating teachers really struggled with teaching, and where a student teacher meant simply another adult in the classroom. We need to do better, not just for our student teachers and our more senior teachers, but better by our students. It seems like common sense that educators who receive the lowest ranking or as amended, who are themselves receiving support, should be exempt from hosting student teachers so that they can focus on their own growth and not someone else's. This bill has the potential to begin to elevate the prestige of the important role of supporting a student teacher, which I think is really important because we need more cooperating teachers, especially high-quality ones. We need to ensure that the Terry Keirs of the world understand how crucial they are to developing new teachers. Thank you for allowing me to speak before you today, and please support Senate File 1185.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lemoyne Korgard, and I'm president of Anoka Hennepin Education Minnesota. We're the largest union of educators in the Anoka Hennepin School District, which is the largest district by enrollment in our state. Senate File 1185 is an important obligation of every school system, which is to help train the next generation of teachers. This obligation falls most heavily on experienced teachers who can share that experience with student teachers. It's extra work, but many teachers take it on because it is so important to the profession. I came here expecting to raise serious questions about the bill because it included a reference to performance rankings. As you may know, the use of high-stakes performance ratings is highly controversial in education circles. We believe performance rankings are ultimately counterproductive for a school because of the competition between teachers they create. Our own evaluation plan in Anoka Hennepin does not use these ratings, so I'm gratified to hear the bill has been changed. It now says a student teacher cannot be placed with a mentor teacher who has been put on an improvement plan. This is a reasonable compromise, and I want to thank Senator Peterson for making the change. While I don't see why a principal would ever place a student teacher with the teacher on an improvement plan, there's nothing wrong with putting it in the statute. Teachers on improvement plans should be focused on their own practice. Once again, we appreciate the change in the bill. We look forward to working with Senator Peterson and the rest of the committee in the future on issues that improve teaching and learning in Minnesota public schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. And we have one more testifier, then we'll open it up for questions, comments. Cindy Christ.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Christ. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I do have an article that you might like to look at if a page could hand it out. It's an article from the Star Tribune of last week, the 23rd of February, about the challenges that our programs are finding, finding placements for student teachers. I would echo in part the comments just made by Mr. Norgard that originally I thought I was going to be coming up here to testify against the bill, but I too think that the amendment is a reasonable compromise, and MACTI supports that. I do just want to make a few statements to you, give you a little bit of a sense about student teaching in case you're not aware of it. Obviously, student teaching is an absolutely critical element of teacher preparation. It's a big part, and I know this from experience. I used to be a classroom teacher. It's a big part of what makes coursework come alive, make sure and make sense. You know, you can hear about things and how they work, but until you're in the classroom in front of kids, you really don't know how it feels. In fact, clinical teaching is so important that our programs over time have included more and earlier placements Currently, on average, in the MACD institutions, the 31 colleges and universities that prepare teachers, students complete an average of 714 hours in the classroom. That's not all student teaching. I tried to do a quick calculation. I'm not sure how many hours would be considered full-time or week-long in a classroom, but at 8 hours a day for 5 days a week, obviously that would be 18 weeks. I think 6 hours might be closer for classrooms, and that's something like 24 weeks. So our students are spending a lot of time in classrooms. We are required to place teachers, student teachers, with fully licensed classroom teachers, and of course we seek the best supervising teachers we possibly can find. There may be an anecdote here and there about a student teacher having a substitute teacher. I can reassure you with almost 99.99% certainty that no one has ever specifically been placed as a substitute teacher. That would not meet statute and program requirements. It certainly is possible that somebody would have been placed with a teacher who then at the last minute had to be replaced by a substitute teacher. I can't speak to the anecdote that's been suggested. I would urge you to be cautious about, from my perspective, making policy based on one or two anecdotes without knowing how often that is the case. I'm sure all of us could find horror stories in any context of life. But it is becoming increasingly difficult for our programs to find student teaching placements. And Kim McGuire in the Star Tribune article, I think, does a great job of capturing them. The very people that we want to be supervising our classroom teachers are the same people the districts want to have serving as mentors to new teachers. They're the same ones they want to have involved in peer evaluations. They're the same ones that school districts want involved in everything. So we try to find the most qualified people that we possibly can. But it comes down for us, as it does for you sometimes, that challenge finding the balance between numbers and quality. And I would just suggest that as you look at these issues, you think about that and try to ensure that we don't set standards for our programs, our Minnesota programs, that are so difficult to meet that it reduces the number of candidates we're preparing and graduating, and therefore leaves districts needing to hire more teachers who haven't met our same high Minnesota standards. But again, I just want to say I thank and applaud Senator Peterson for the amendment here. We absolutely think that makes sense, and so we do support the bill as amended. Thank you.
Looks like we're on a roll here. And is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 995 as amended?
1185.
Excuse me. 1185. 995 will be next on. We're going to talk about the teaching as well. No one else? Senator Peterson, additional comments in closing? We're going to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus, as we are doing for other policy bills. It looks like it's on a great launch right now.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would just say, you know, as you've heard, I think we've struck a balance amongst all the interests at the table, and you know, in support of what, you know, everyone universally suggests, which is this is a very important sort of stepping off point for our young teachers, and that this bill will just help reinforce that and give everyone the most opportunity to be successful. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Senator Johnson does have a question.
I have a couple of questions. I'd like to take this opportunity to find out, get some extra information. How are placements determined? Are teachers required to take on a student teacher? Is there extra pay for mentoring student teachers? And what do you do if there is not a placement for a student teacher? Can they get their license?
Well,
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think it depends. It varies from district to district with regard to how they end up getting placed. Obviously, this bill would place some more, you know, standards around exactly what that looks like. But, you know, and it also, I think, in depending on the district, depends on sort of what teachers are available. As with regard to compensation, again, I would imagine that would be something negotiated at the local level. I'm not aware of any districts, but I don't know if Mr. Korgard could speak to Anoka Hennepin.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. In our district, Anoka Hennepin, It is in our contract that if you do choose to take on the responsibilities of mentoring a student teacher, you're paid, I believe it's $100 for the experience. We're not in it for the money at that point. We're in it to mentor and bring strong candidates into the profession. Mm-hmm. Other districts, I haven't seen an amount in some of them, but some of them don't pay anything. I don't know of any district where the district has the right to assign a student teacher to a supervising teacher or to a mentor. It's typically done on a volunteer basis, who's willing. And the reason that I think we're starting to see a crunch with trying to place student teachers, quite frankly, is very related to workload of, as she alluded to, the workload of other responsibilities they're giving the more experienced teachers as well as the most qualified teachers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Peterson moves that Senate File 1185 as amended be laid over. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good work. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
On the same subject of student teaching, we're going to go next to Senator Clausen, 959. And if Ms. Christ could join him, I don't think it'll take very long. And then we'll be going to Senate File 995 on concurrent enrollment. Senate File 959, year-long student teaching programs.
Well, good morning, Senator Wieger and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 959, a proposal to provide an authentic year-long student teaching experience for Minnesota educated teacher candidates. And I do have an A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
It's being distributed. If you'd like to describe it.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment clarifies the starting date for the program, adds an appropriation, and identifies Senate File 959 as a Minsky pilot program. So those are the clarifying items in the A2.
We'll act on it as soon as everyone has it in front of them. We have the author's A2 amendment. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Carried.
Thank you.
As amended, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Peterson's bill pointed out, student teaching is one of the core requirements and culminating experience of the teacher preparation process. Currently, Minnesota teacher preparation institutions require a 12 to 16-week, generally, student teaching experience. Senate File 959 provides for an optional academic year-long teaching experience in conjunction with pedagogy and methods courses included within the year-long student teaching experience framework. And to be clear, this proposal will not add an additional year to the student's coursework. A year-long student teaching experience allows a teacher candidate the opportunity to be a true faculty member within the school professional teaching community. A longer teaching experience allows the students to gain greater knowledge of school policies, procedures, more time for reflective practice and experience, more time to be mentored, more time to be truly integrated into the responsibilities of a teacher, enabling a more realistic transition to the first year of having a classroom of their own. And this is not a revolutionary idea. Several European countries use a similar model, while Arizona, Indiana, and Iowa have pilots using a similar year-long model. I envision a model whereby the student teacher and the mentoring teacher will co-teach with the students, doing more observation early in the program and transitioning to a more lead teaching as they gain experience. This proposal is a pilot program, will foster the development of better prepared teachers for Minnesota schools and classrooms. And with us today is Cindy Christ, Legislative and Policy Liaison, representing the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. Ms. Christ.
Mr. Chair, members, Cindy Christ with MACD. You've already heard most of my spiel about student teaching, so I'll just say a couple of things briefly. We would frankly love to have all of our students complete a full year of student teaching. I know the bill, even before it was amended, did not require that. Our institutions were concerned about having to offer a year-long experience to all students because it would take, obviously, some time, and therefore there would be some resource expenditures to put something together when we're not sure how well it worked for students. So I think that the amendment in this bill helps address that problem. It will let a couple of institutions focus on this and, through the pilot process, identify what the costs of year-long student teaching might be to colleges and universities, to school districts, more importantly, to students, some of whom already have trouble completing 12 or 14 weeks of student teaching full-time. It would help them identify options for how this might happen. I don't know if Senator Claussen envisions that year-long student teaching would be all day, every day for a full year, but if there are some options where it might be, some of those days might be part-time student teaching, part-time doing coursework or reflection, working on the EdTPA. I would think a pilot might be able to identify some of those potential options to make it workable. And again, as I said, how to help students manage the costs. That's a great concern to us, because even if all of our institutions were to be required to offer student year-long student teaching experiences, but students didn't have to complete them, it seems possible that those who would actually complete them would be the ones who couldn't afford to do so. And we would hate for a statutory change to inadvertently further disadvantage students who are already having trouble doing a 14-week student teaching placement. So I think this idea of a funded pilot project is really a great way to let a couple of institutions sort through all of these issues, really think about how to make it work. I'm sure that they will collaborate with P-12 partners and talk to students about how this might work and where it might work and when it might work, and then come forward with some ideas that will either help us figure out how to make this work or potentially raise what may seem like insurmountable obstacles that we could then bring back to you for your consideration before requiring all institutions to make these pilots available. So I know that I can't imagine there'll be any trouble, MNSCU board, finding a couple of state universities who will be willing to work on this. And like all of you, we really look forward to seeing the results of those pilot projects.
Thank you. Ms. Chris Sarabano.
Mr. Chair, so with the amendment, then the bill would need to come to higher ed, because then the amendment says it would be the appropriation would go to MNSCU, right, Mr. Chair?
Yep. Go to finance, and if it's going to be MNSCU, I believe that would be higher ed.
Yeah. So you know, we would want to take a look at that. But I guess, Senator Claussen, I'm wondering how in this language do you ensure that the student now isn't having to take additional time to complete their degree? You said that was the intent of the bill, but I don't see how the language would dictate that. And then I'm wondering, and perhaps Ms. Chris could say this, when you talk about the cost for the student, what are you referring to? Are you referring to that perhaps a student might be working while going to school, and if they're student teaching, they couldn't be doing that? Where are those in costs incurred for the student? And where, in fact, would the costs be incurred for the institution? I'm still not understanding how, if a student teacher is spending an entire year versus the 14 weeks, why doing that would cost the whichever institution was providing the pilot, where would those costs be incurred? So it's a few different questions.
Okay. Why don't I go first, Mr. Chair? And thank you, Senator Obama, for that question. Typically, in the teacher preparation program, the last year of the student schooling, part of that year is spent in the student teaching, but part of it is spent also taking methodology classes. And what I envision in this program, and again, we're leaving it somewhat open so that institutions, along with the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, can work on a pilot that they believe is workable. But I would envision that the student would be taking those methodology classes early in that year-long student teaching experience. So it could be they spend one day on campus, 4 days in a classroom out in a school district. So that would be a model that I see developing, but we didn't want to be overly prescriptive on how that might develop with the institutions.
Just a follow-up.
Senator Bonner.
Mr.
Again,
Chair.
Your committee will have a hearing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Klassen, it just seems to me that you may want to include language specifying that intent, because the minute, you know, we leave here, certainly it could be interpreted differently without being prescriptive, but somehow to outline that that the bill's intent is to keep the same. I don't know how you'd say it, but okay. Ms. Crist.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, good suggestion.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Clausen, I think.
Well,
did you have?
Go ahead.
Okay. I certainly understand the value of the year-long program. I think one of the questions I have is probably more deals with some logistic issues. And I'm thinking about my districts back from where I come from. That student teacher may come in from Marshall, which is 70 miles away, maybe Mankato, which is 120, 30 miles away. You know, it's one thing to find the necessary living arrangements, et cetera, for a 12, 14-week period. Now we're talking about a year-long period. Have you visited with the high school system as to, you know, in the long term, saying that you find an acceptable way of making this work in your pilot projects, if this becomes a long-term mandatory thing, I can see in some respects you're actually eliminating many of my schools from ever maybe having a chance to participate. Have you visited with them about those issues?
Chair Klaus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, this is an option. It would not necessarily be a requirement to do a year-long teaching experience. So I think we'd still have that option available. I think that you raised some good questions. I know that currently there are people that teach outstate Minnesota, shall we say, and they do need to find living accommodations while they're doing that. Of course, doing that for a year may be more of a difficult challenge. So that is something that we're trying to look at as not making this mandatory, but as an option.
Okay. Senator Boffin, then follow up for...
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bonoff, and I'm glad that actually that Senator Weber asked his questions first, because he helped crystallize a couple of additional things in my mind. So just, you know, starting with the students, there could be additional travel costs, costs of housing. I know when I did my student teaching, I drove back and forth every day, and if I had to do that for a full year rather than a semester, you know, there would have been some additional costs. Students, of course, pay tuition for student teaching, and you know, that helps cover all the costs to us of finding and managing the placements. Our institutions all have field experience directors who are responsible for finding the placements, finding the working with the supervising teachers, observing them, observing the teacher candidates. So if they're having to travel out to districts more often for every student, those would be some of the additional costs. For students, certainly foregone income would be one of our concerns. That's what makes it hard for some of them now to student teach. They need to work full-time, so they're going to school full-time, and when they have to student teach full-time during the day, sometimes they can't make alternate arrangements for work. The other thing about, and then there would be additional costs presumably for the supervising teachers, although as previously pointed out, they're paid a pittance, but part of the additional costs for our institutions, we assumed, based on the language in the bill on page 2 that describes the components of this year-long student teaching program, because it says it would combine clinical opportunities with academic coursework, in-depth student teaching experiences, coaching assessment, and so on. One way to read that would be that the student would be placed full-time in the school where they're student teaching, but part of that experience might be coursework offered on-site there or nearby for student teachers, if it's a sort of a professional school model. So we're not quite sure how that would work. And any time at a college university that changes have to be made in programs in terms of when courses are delivered and how they're delivered and to whom they're delivered, there's some resource costs in determining that. So some of those greater institutional costs would likely be one-time costs of sorting through this. Again, a reason that I think the pilot program is so important, because they can figure that out.
Thank you.
Further questions, comments? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address this issue? If not, Senate file, Senator Clausen, would you like to make a motion on Senate file 959 as amended?
Senator Wieger. I would like to move that Senate file 959 as amended be laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
In this case, it would be recommend that it pass and be referred to finance.
Be referred to finance, yes. Thank you.
Further discussion? All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Clausen and testifier. And Senator Clausen will continue on concurrent enrollment, other items, and many of you are here for that bill, so we'll go next to Senate File 995, concurrent enrollment. I believe we have about 14 people set to testify. We'd like to go to about 10 o'clock if we could. And this does have a fiscal note in it, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of good support as to the need, and we'll look forward to hearing that, especially from students that are here. Senator Pearson.
Mr. Chair, I just looking at the schedule for the committee today, and of course, you know, it's at your discretion.
Yes.
So looking at the list of testifiers for this bill, and then we've got Senate File 990. I was curious if we could arrange that differently, and then at the very least, we know we can get through the bills that are on the calendar. It's up to you.
We have two bills left, and yeah. The plan was to go till 10 on that, and then go to 990 at 10 o'clock.
Okay, I was just because we got how many? 15.
The others have been disposed of.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. Hey, thank you, Senator Clausen.
Well, thank you, Chair Wieger, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity today to present Senate File 995. It's a proposal to support concurrent enrollment courses in Minnesota high schools. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce the A3 amendment, please.
Has that been distributed? Okay. If you could please highlight it, and as it's being distributed, then we'll promptly act on it. I see it's rather lengthy.
It is, Mr. Chair, and I'll just go over some of the key items. In Section 4, Subdivision 10A, it requires post-secondary institutions offering concurrent enrollment courses to conduct annual and five-year follow-up participation surveys. Requirements for reporting include data analysis and survey content are also identified in that subdivision. Section 5, Subdivision 10B creates concurrent enrollment advisory board requirements, and that outlines duties and representation. Section 6, Minnesota Statute 2014, Section 124D.091, Subdivision 1, requires post-secondary institutions offering concurrent enrollment courses to adopt and implement the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnership Standards and Evidence of Accreditation. And finally, on page 4, line 7 and 13, clarity is given to the awarding of grants through the Office of Higher Education and Minnesota Department of Education.
Okay, this is an author's amendment, the A3, as highlighted. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we have Senate File 995 as amended. Senator Clausen, and we have many testifiers, and we would like to hear from them.
We'll move ahead. Concurrent enrollment is a dual credit program which allows college-ready high school students the opportunity to take post-secondary courses for high school and college credit. Concurrent enrollment courses are taught in the high school by qualified high school teachers in conjunction with University of Minnesota and MNSCU institutions. And Senate File 995, there are four main objectives. The first, to provide adequate funding to support concurrent enrollment programs. Secondly, to expand the ability for both high schools and post-secondary institutions to participate in the program. Third, to provide greater opportunity for teacher staff development. And fourth, to create greater governance and oversight for concurrent enrollment programs. I'd like to just present a few Minnesota concurrent enrollment by the numbers. Over 23,000 students participated in concurrent enrollment courses in 2013. 16% of the students were from low-income families. This is a 41% increase over the past 6 years. 10% of the students were from minority populations, a 51% increase from 2007. During the 2013-14 school year, students earned over 208,000 credits in 59,749 concurrent enrollment courses offered by local high schools in partnership with 27 University of Minnesota and Minsky institutions. I'd like to just quickly review some of the sections that are contained in Senate File 995. Section 1 includes in the rigorous course taking reporting requirements, career and technical education concurrent enrollment courses. Sections 2 and 3 clarify student eligibility. Section 2, at the discretion of the school district and the post-secondary institution, 9th and 10th grade students may enroll in concurrent courses. Section 3, students in the original language were able to enroll in concurrent courses for 4 academic years. The additional language in Senate File 995 allows school district to extend the number of years that the student is not on track to graduate in 4 years. Section 4 appropriates from the Office of Higher Education, Subdivision 1 and 2, identify appropriations for post-secondary institutions to expand existing course offerings and develop new courses. Section 5 identifies appropriations to Minnesota Department of Education. Subdivision 2 appropriates funds to compensate higher education institutions for costs associated with providing concurrent enrollment courses. Subdivision 3 provides grant opportunities to community organizations to disseminate information to students and families regarding concurrent enrollment programs. Subdivision 4 provides grants to school districts to develop concurrent enrollment courses. Subdivision 5 provides funding for teacher staff development workshops sponsored by the post-secondary institution. And lastly, Subdivision 6 provides grant funding for teacher coursework necessary to be qualified to teach college-level courses. So that constitutes the main pieces of the Senate File 995. I'd like to turn your attention to the handouts we've provided and just rather quickly review them. And I believe they're in order that I'll be referencing. The first one asked the question, why are dual credit courses valuable in closing the achievement gap and helping all students? And that does talk about college debt. It also talks about the success rate of concurrent enrollment programs in student success in post-secondary institutions. The second handout, which is in portrait form, is the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, the standards and required evidence of accreditation. And you may recall in the amendment, this is a requirement for all institutions that are going to be offering concurrent enrollment courses in our state. And so you can look through that. There's a third item that I believe one of our testifiers today will talk a little bit more about, but it's a Education Minnesota statewide four-year graduation rates, and it identifies students that took concurrent enrollment courses, and it shows their effectiveness in doing so. The next piece of information comes to us from from Superintendent Chris Lindholm of the Pequot Lakes School District. I might add that Chris is a graduate of Rosemont High School when I was the principal. Okay. But he offers a great testimony about the difference between students leaving the campus and taking PSEO courses at a distant college or university and having that those same courses available in his district. If you look at the dollar amounts, it's pretty compelling to see how this is saving school districts money and at the same time providing some great opportunities for students. The next piece that I'd like to reference is a letter, or an email rather, received from Community of Peace Academy. In the fall, I visited 15 school districts, schools, charter schools, private schools, public schools around the state, gathering information about participation in the college and the schools programs or concurrent enrollment programs. And you can see that there's some additional information that's provided, and we will have a testifier referencing this perhaps as well. There are some other pieces of information. There's often a question about credit recognition, and this is a document from the University of Minnesota College and the Schools, and it identifies all the institutions around the United States where the concurrent enrollment credits have been received and transferred. And then in my own school district, District 196, Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools, last year $2.5 million in University of Minnesota credits were earned by students in that district. And it gives you an overview of that. Each school that participates, each school district that participates in the College and the Schools program at the University of Minnesota receives a summary statement like this that shows the success of the program in their district. And then the last two pieces are examples of the studies that I referenced in the amendment. These are studies that are required for schools that are institutions, post-secondary institutions that are offering concurrent enrollment courses. And one is a annual study that is done. This is from the year 2013. And the other is a five-year follow-up study. And again, this is required by the accrediting national institution. With that, Mr. Chair, we have a number of testifiers. What I am going to do is to step away, and I'm just going to allow them to come up. They have an order that has been provided to them, and they will provide testimony, and then I will come up for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. And again, we'd like to conclude this part. It will be going to finance, but by 10 o'clock or so, and I don't believe there's anyone here that would be in opposition, but it's good to hear the success stories that we're about to hear on the return on investment. And for a reminder for testifiers, just please state your name, who you're representing for the record. And if we could have maybe three at a time at the table, that would be appreciated. Okay, welcome.
Well, my name is Julie Williams. I'm the Director of College and the Schools at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. Senator Clausen asked me to give you a brief overview of the concurrent enrollment program at the U of M Twin Cities. So I'll start with that, and then he also asked me to address our evaluation piece. We were started more than 25 years ago, and we are the largest concurrent enrollment program in the state. We have about, last year we served a little over 8,000 students, and they earned a little over 52,000 credits, University of Minnesota credits. And we processed 13,000 course registrations. We work with almost 400 high school instructors and about 135 different high schools. We offer 41 University of Minnesota courses. And we served a student population that included 22% students of color and I think about 72% Caucasian students. So it's important to know about the College and the Schools program that the students earn high school and University of Minnesota credit for the courses that are taken through CIS, and that the credit is recorded on an official University of Minnesota transcript. There's no indication on the transcript that the courses were taken through a concurrent enrollment program, and the students are considered University of Minnesota students. The courses we offer are undergraduate University of Minnesota courses. They appear in the U of M catalog. They're offered on the U of M campus. We don't develop any courses specifically for high school students. Our promise to parents and to students and the university and to you is that the courses offered through CIS are the same, with the same rigor and student expectations as the courses that are taught on the U of M campus. And I think the most important way that we demonstrate our commitment to the integrity of the U of M courses is through our accreditation by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, which is NACEP. And through that accreditation process, we have documented that we meet standards that apply to curriculum, student support and assessment, instructor qualifications, and program evaluation. And Senator Clausen asked me briefly to describe our program evaluation piece. It's been a really important part of our success, and so I'm glad to see that that has been entered into the bill. Each year, we survey former CIS students who have been out of high school for 1 year, and we do that to find out whether they were able to use the U of M credits that they earned through college and the schools, and then how satisfied they were with the program. On average, for the past 7 years of the surveys, 93% of the respondents who attend colleges and universities other than the U of M and coast to coast have reported being able to use the credits that they earned through CIS. So those credits might be transferred to meet graduation requirements or electives, or they might allow the student to participate in advanced courses before, or I'm sorry, in an advanced level courses when they enter their college or university. And on average, for the past 7 years, 98% of the respondents would recommend college and the school to high school students. So one of the most common comments on the survey is that students wish they had taken more of the courses through college and the schools. And I want to say that this year is the very first year since 2006 when I started with the program that we will not be growing. We have grown on average 12% each year, and we won't be growing at all this year. When we surveyed our principals about that issue, cost was one of the top three reasons for not being able to expand the college and the schools program. So in addition to the annual survey, every three years we survey former CIS students who have been out of college for 4 years. I'm sorry, out of high school for 4 years. And we want to see whether the credits that they earned through CIS made a difference in their trajectory. So did they graduate early, or did it make it possible for them to study abroad or participate in internships or take a double major or minor? And then every 3 years, we also survey teachers, counselors, and principals, and that's the survey I referenced earlier. I think one of the most important insights that we've gleaned from the surveys is how important it is to invest in the teachers that we work with. And I appreciate that this is also addressed in the bill. The teachers repeatedly comment on how much working with the university faculty and other CIS teachers re-energizes their teaching and affects their expectations for students, not only in the college and the schools courses, but in all of the courses that they teach at their high school. And the students very often comment on how much the quality of their experience in the U of M course depends on the teacher quality. It's common in those surveys for the students to admit that they complained about the amount of work that they had to do when they were in the high school course, but how much they appreciate later that their teacher pushed them, because 1 year out, they see the value in learning how to study before they begin classes at a university or college. And I'm going to turn this over now to Professor Timothy Johnson.
Thank you,
Ms. Williams. He is a faculty coordinator at the U of M.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm Professor Timothy Johnson. I coordinate the political science program at the University of Minnesota, and so I oversee, I believe, 21 now teachers, both in the metro and outside of the metro, teaching our Introduction to American Politics class. So these are teachers who are teaching what we normally teach in our department to between 85 and 200 students in a lecture setting, much smaller classes, what would be akin to our honor sections, if you will, where I would teach between 15 and 20 of our top freshmen in this class, and so they have a much more intimate setting. Julie asked me to speak specifically about the idea of oversight to guarantee that these courses have the same rigor that we have at the university within our classrooms. And I'll be very brief, but I want to make clear how we try to guarantee that that rigor is the same. We do a number of specific things with our teachers to help them make sure that they are prepared to teach these courses, and then that they continue to be prepared as the years go on, as they are in the program for 1 and 5 and some now for 20 years. Each year I pick between 5 and 8. I've never gone to more than 8 because it's time-consuming classes to observe. And in fact, sometimes I go beyond those 5 to 8 because I go and will give specific lectures that the teachers would like me to give in my area of expertise. But most often I will go to the classrooms and sit in the back. I try to be as disruptive or not as, as undisruptive as humanly possible. Excuse me. And really just get a sense of how the teachers teach. And for me, that is often a difficult time because as a university professor, I'm not a trained teacher, right? I don't have a degree in education, and these teachers do. And so in some sense, it's actually selfish for me to be in a classroom because I learn a lot about pedagogy from these teachers who are experts in what they do, and that is teaching high school students. And so there is some give and take there. That said, the time that I'm in the classroom, I'm really concentrating on the substance that the teachers provide to their students and the degree to which they have, as I said, and as I know you care about, that rigor that we have in our classrooms. Now, they inherently have an advantage over what I do when I teach this course, and that is they see their students every single day for 50 minutes a day. And so they actually are getting more face time with their students. And so I think in some sense, there's going to be more rigor there just because of the amount of time. But it's the substance that we really care about. And so I will sit and talk with the teachers prior to me coming to class and after I've been in class and talk about the issues that they're teaching to their students. So that's one big piece of oversight. The other is that I meet with my teachers 3 times a year, a fourth when they bring their students to campus for the culmination of their CIS experience, the field day. But we have 3 in-service days in April and August and October where we go over many different issues. But the keys to these meetings are twofold. One is we do talk about pedagogy for a large portion of that meeting. We talk about our common assessments. We talk about how to teach particular topics. We talk about how to actually grade papers, how to grade exams, and try to come up with making sure that we are grading the students the same, not only between the campus and the schools, but across the schools as well. My cohort in particular has 1 common assignment as well, and so we know that all of the teachers are grading 1 paper that is the same across all of the schools, and so that has helped us with assessment as well. And then finally, and I think it's the teacher's favorite part of these in-service days, they will have a lecture, sometimes from me, most often from my colleagues, about a particular substantive part of American politics. So during an election year, the fall of 2016, for instance, we will have in one of my colleagues who is an expert on the upcoming election. And they will talk to the teachers in a way that we would talk to other political scientists, and so that they can then turn around and give that same substance to their students. The last piece, and then I will turn it over, is that our teachers will actually meet with me on a regular basis the summer before they begin teaching the course. I only have 1 new teacher who will begin in the fall, and he and I will begin discussions at the end of May. And we will meet in person at his school, maybe at the U, at a coffee shop. We will be in constant contact via email. We will go through the textbook. We will go through assessments. And we just make sure that he will be fully ready. And I do that with all of my teachers. And I know that that's the same across all of the CIS courses at the University of Minnesota. So just to be clear, we try to make sure that this is as rigorous as every class that we teach at the U. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome. Senator Peterson, we're going to hold on questions so we've heard from testifiers. Yes, please.
Chairman, welcome. My name is Mark Mischke. I'm the principal of Buffalo High School. And there's a green piece of paper. Many of it you had green, and some of you I think it turned into white. But I'll briefly reference my comments or my points on this green piece of paper. I think it summarizes it, but I'll talk to it briefly and then turn the mic over to our students. Yep.
Yes.
That's the one. So the history of dual credit enrollment at Buffalo High School. The 4 goal areas that I'd wanted to target this morning, and first and foremost, I just wanted to extend a compliment to Senator Claussen in watching and looking through the bill of Senate File 995, I would describe it as hitting the mark almost exactly in terms of the needs of our schools in moving forward with concurrent enrollment. And so I just want to lend a compliment to him and his work on that. And as you can see, the four goal areas that we target with our dual credit options really are repetitive in the sense of they apply right to the bill. Increased access for more of our students. Our goal, we have 523 ninth graders coming into our high school next year, and our goal is that every one of those students have access to concurrent enrollment options during their time at our high school. The second bullet, decreasing the need for remedial courses at college. I know it's a conversation that occurs quite frequently. With our opportunity to bring college-level course options to our younger students, it allows them to step into college and to be more successful with less remedial course options or needed. The third part that kind of alludes to the side, and then I'm going to have you flip over the document in a second. The debt for our students, in particular at Buffalo High School. The columns on the left-hand side is just a nine-year history of our school, kind of a snapshot of our high school in terms of students and their credit options. And if you flip it over, it's more of a breakdown on financially on what we spend at Buffalo High School. And Ms. Williams and Mr. Johnson sitting at the table here next to me earlier are part of our partnership with the U, which is an outstanding partnership that we pride ourselves in the accomplishments our students have in that area. And as I look at this breakdown and walk through it with you briefly, what you can see is we currently are partnered with the U of M, Southwest State, St. Cloud State, and totaling roughly 665 students last year, and 750 students are planned for this year. And so as a district, it costs us roughly $100,000 a year to produce a comprehensive CIS plan in our building. And yet, as you can see in many of the papers you have in front of you along with this, our students and our families are saving upwards of $700,000 to $750,000 annually with these partnerships. And so although it's a great savings for our students and family, there is a cost accrued at a district level. And so hopefully, as you can see with this one example, a way that this bill can support offsetting some of those costs for Buffalo High School and other districts throughout the state. So, and then in closing, the last part I would want to make is creating true partnerships K-12 and higher ed. Ms. Williams is one of our connections that really show as she works with Buffalo High School and many other schools throughout the state. This is an opportunity to bring people together instead of talking about my students and your students. It really is a genuine our student conversation, which is very exciting as well. So thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Tim Walden, principal at Wiper Lake High School. And I want to just compliment Senator Wieger and Senator Klassen. Had the opportunity to host both of you at our high school this past fall, and appreciate and applaud you for the research you've done in crafting this bill. I also echo everything Principal Mischke just shared with you. But I want to also share a story of a recent 2011 Wiper Lake graduate and a conversation I had with her about her excitement about her pending graduation from the University of Minnesota this spring. As a young Hmong student in high school, she had limited examples of family members and people close to her who had success at the university level, and she didn't have a vision for what life at the university would look like for her and how she would access that. And she shared that through the support of her counselor and her teachers, who encouraged her to take a college in the schools class, and reflecting on her success in that class, she really felt the university was a possibility for her. She shared that in her first college in the schools class visit to the University of Minnesota, where she had the opportunity to interact with the university of professors and other high school students from around the state who were taking the college in the schools courses, it was at that point where she realized, I belong here. And now in 2015, she's just preparing for her exit, her graduation from the University of Minnesota. That's a story that can be echoed across Minnesota schools for college in the schools students. College in the schools is about rigor and college readiness. It's also about equity and access. And the PSEO programs, while they work great for some of our students, they don't reflect the equity and the access that our college in the schools programs provide our students on our campus with the support of their classroom teachers. We offer 38 college credit-bearing courses in our high school, 17 of which are concurrent enrollment. And there are challenges offering the concurrent enrollment because we are not only paying the teacher, for their service. We're also paying for their college credit, which I would suggest is not the responsibility of K-12. I'll turn it over to one of our students in White Bear, Spencer Grissom.
Thank you, Principal, and welcome, Spencer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm Spencer Grissom, and I am a senior at White Bear Lake High School. Start out, excuse the sniffles up here, too. I got a little cold, but I'm trying to get over it now. Thank you. So, in high school, I am either currently in or have taken a total of 8 college classes, 5 of which were AP, 3 of which were CIS. And the CIS have, for me, been a much better experience. I was in the political science CIS course that Mr. Johnson has hosted. For that course, it offered a much more applicable experience to what, as opposed to an AP course. An AP course focuses mostly on teaching to the test. And when you're teaching to a test, you don't want, it's really, really hard to delve deeper into a subject that you may find interesting because you're cramming for a specific test. And in a CIS course, you do have a cumulative final at the end of the year, but it is the course that you're in is not specifically directed towards passing that test. So in the CIS political science course, which was, I also took have 2 CIS Spanish courses that I'm in, but the CIS political science course was much more flexible and much more applicable to what I want to do. So in that course, we learned about a specific court case, Supreme Court case that's taking place either right now or already took place. And so we had to write a paper on that. And then after we wrote our paper, we took a field day to the University of Minnesota, and we met with a sort of committee of different students to talk about our findings on the court case and whether we think what the verdict should be. And this was a really amazing experience because we went into that room not knowing any of those students. We may know some of them because some of them were from our school, but we didn't know most of them, and yet we came out with a pretty good idea of what we wanted to say to the entire group. And then we came out of those rooms with a decision, an opinion of what the Supreme Court would say. We came out and then we presented it to the large group, which was 300-some students. Can't remember. But so that experience was so applicable to the subject that it blossomed some hidden passions for political science, and that was really important. And also the CIS versus PSEO. I know Mr. Wald touched on some of this, but for me, it was extremely important to stay on campus my senior year because it's my senior year. I still want to stay with all my friends, but a senior year on campus was very important to me. So, so with the CIS classes, I could still get the same. I'm at a loss for words at the moment. I could still get the same rigor of courses that a PSEO course would offer. And with those same courses, I saved a ton of money. I'm in the process of saving a ton of money right now. And that's not the main reason, but that helps a lot. So if we could get more funding for the CIS courses, I know other kids would save a ton of money. Maybe those kids who are struggling to pay for college, they could save almost an entire year of college money to start out with. So,
well, thank you very much, Ms. Grayson. Senator Klassen.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I know that we're time locked here, so I'd really like to encourage keeping comments brief. And we've had a lot of people that have traveled here, and their testimony is important. But if we could be as time conscious as possible. Thank you.
Certainly. Well, Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Paul Jokinen. I'm also a senior at White Bear Lake Area High School, and I've had the opportunities to take 11 college-level courses in my high school career, 3 of which have been CIS courses, 1 in American history and 1 in, 2 in Spanish. And I'd like to echo what Spencer was commenting on earlier about the ability and flexibility of the curriculum and how this allows us to take advantage of some of the specialties of the educators in our high school. An example of this comes from my history course, where the teacher who taught it, he had done graduate studies focusing on the interactions between Native Americans and the United States government in the time period that our class was studying. And so he was able to delve deeper into that material and really teach us that, and able to kind of spark our interest in it to a deeper extent than he would have been able to if the course had been an AP course that was more rigid in its curriculum. Another important facet of this class is the study of historiography, which is contrasting interpretations from various historians on a single historical event and using multiple interpretations to kind of get to the bottom of how that event impacted other events in history. And this is a study that I only encountered through the CIS course, and it really isn't included in other courses, especially the AP history courses I've been able to take. And I feel it's very valuable to a modern study of history to have this. Overall, this history course that I took and the Spanish courses I've taken as well have really sparked my interest in these fields. Some people report coming out of AP classes feeling kind of burned out on a subject or something like that. But if anything, I come out of my CIS courses more excited to learn about these topics and more encouraged to pursue a further study of them. And I think this stems because from the focus of both these courses. They're both extremely rigorous, but in general, from my experiences, I found that AP encourages a strong development of study skills and a retention of information. But I also feel that CIS encourages a development of deep critical thinking, which is what is important to these people as they approach college. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for each of your testimony. And I believe we have three from Egan. If they would all like to highlight.
Actually, I'm next.
Okay. Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I'm a college in the schools teacher from Community of Peace Academy, which is on the east side of St. Paul. We have almost 100% students of color. 85% students are free and reduced lunch, and the majority of our students will be first-generation college students. I want to just speak about one aspect of how special this program is to students from those backgrounds, since we want to keep
you're
things
Courtney
brief. Courtney Hum, yeah, that's correct.
Yes,
thank you. The main thing that is so special about college and the schools at my school is that teachers who know my students are able to experience their first college class with them. So the ability for me to have students who I've known since they were in ninth grade as 11th and 12th grade college and the school students allows me to help them through the struggles of what it is to take college level courses. Since these students are first generation, frequently when they go to college, it can be very overwhelming and they don't know who to turn to for assistance when they're going through struggles with their first college courses. CIS allows students to have the support from people that they know and students that they know in their classes, and we're able to do things as a community rather than sending them off to colleges where they have less support structure. So that is one of the main reasons why college in the schools is so important for our urban schools and for our first-generation college students. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Rita Anderson. I teach college in the schools at Egan High School, and I brought two students with me. I'll try not repeat what everyone else has said. I have been teaching forever. Well, I just realized when he started talking about it, I've been teaching CIS. I was in the first group. I've been teaching, I think Susan Henderson would, since 1987. CIS literature was the very first CIS course. And now with everybody, when I think about going to the meetings, I'm pretty sure I'm the oldest person teaching CIS in the state.
Most experienced.
Which sounded a lot better in my head than it did when I just said it out loud. Anyway, what I guess I'd like to just say about it is that it's a threefold thing. Originally, you know, when it first started, post-secondary enrollment, the U of M was getting kids that I don't think they thought they would get at post-secondary enrollment. And they came back, and that's why we started this Lit course in 1987 was to keep the kids that they really wanted to work with in the high school. Because those kids were like, well, we don't want to leave the high school because we have basketball practice and we have speech practice and we have all these things. And so it really created kind of a community of really great kids that wanted to take college courses. So that's, if you want to know any background, I can take you way back to that. Three things. Kids. It bridges for kids. It bridges high school with college. When I teach this course, it's all about, you know, getting them to have one foot in high school but be moving on to the college level. And so I not only do that with the rigor of the course, but also with little tips of things that will help them in college. It's amazing for teachers who are in the college and schools program because the professional development is the best professional development I've ever had in my 34 years of teaching, by far, any professional development I get from the University of Minnesota. And it's amazing for parents because, of course, financially it is amazing for them, but also it gives them kind of a peace of mind when their kids are taking this college course in high school and they can see it mimics the success that they're going to have when they go on. On a more personal note, both of my children took college and schools courses from me, didn't get A's, just want to point that out. And one went to Madison, one is at the University of St. Thomas, and both of them were able to not only transfer the credits, but oftentimes take courses at a higher level. I'll let Megan and Bianca talk.
Richie was the first.
Yes, please welcome and share your statements.
Thank you. I'm Megan Law, and I'm a senior at Egan High School this year. And next year, I will be attending the University of Iowa. I am directly admitted into the nursing program instead of having to apply during my freshman year. So I will graduate in 4 years instead of four and a half years. And because of this strict program at University of Iowa, most kids aren't allowed to study abroad because it's so set. The schedule is set for 4 years, and you take those classes, and that's what you do. But I'm coming in with 25 credits from the U of M, and because of that, I will be able to go abroad for one semester and complete a Spanish minor, which also wouldn't be possible without my college and schools credit. So because of that, I am thankful for the fact that I could take these classes, and I think it's an awesome opportunity, both in high school and then for future in college.
Muy bien.
Hello, my name is Bianca Nkwanta. I'm also a senior at Egan High School. And right now, I'm currently in between four large public universities in different states. And when I've maintained contact with those schools, they've all told me that the courses that I've taken through the University of Minnesota at my high school will be able to transfer, and that I'd be able to have like more opportunities, like Megan said, to study abroad. Like, I want to complete a Spanish minor as well. I'd be able to study abroad. I'd be able to take part in certain internships in business and biology. Those are two things I'm interested in. And the U of M and their CIS courses have been a great help to me also because I've one thing that's like a major deciding factor for which school I'm going to is the cost of attendance. And these courses greatly decrease the amount of courses that I'm going to take my freshman year that I can take in high school. So it allows me to move forward and take courses that I would be taking maybe my sophomore or junior year in college during my freshman year in university, regardless of where I go.
Thank you. Very impressive.
Thank you for letting us.
Thank you for service. I believe we have four additional testifiers that they could all join at the table, and you're making a very powerful, cogent case. Welcome to each of you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Bob Hennon, principal at Watertown Mare High School. I've had the unique opportunity. I taught in the CIS program through the U of M for 7 years, and it's ironic. Tim Johnson's here. He was the one that took me through all my training for the political science class, and I got to teach four different classes. And I would echo what other people have said about the professional development we get. It is the best professional development I have ever received as a teacher, and I know we have 9 teachers currently teaching CIS, and it has raised the bar, and I think we have more and more teachers who want to go through that process. But the most important thing I think it's done for our high school, and as a principal I see it even more, is we are seeing more and more kids who are college ready than ever before. At our school we offer 16 CIS courses for a total of 64 credits. And last year, our graduating class, out of 105 kids, 67 graduated with some CIS credits for a total of about 1,200 credits. And it was hundreds of thousands of dollars of savings. But what we're seeing is our kids taking classes all the way through their senior year. Math and science especially has been the big push. But for our area, which is a heavily rural area, we're also offering things such as CIS plant science, animal science, that reaches a whole different population than ever before. Instead of just the top 20 to 30% of our students getting college in the schools, we're seeing, again, a much diverse population. And it's been a huge success, and the culture of our school is one where now we're wanting kids to be in classes like that, and they're not trying to, I hate to say, the senior kind of slide. Yeah. They're still taking the CIS courses, and it's been just a tremendous success for our school.
Thank you very much, Principal. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Radosovich. I'm here representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber and our member businesses are highly focused on preparing the state's future workforce. And concurrent enrollment and other dual credit options help students progress along their education and career path, whatever it may be, in a timely and cost-effective manner. And as you've heard today, I think one of the most exciting things about these options is that it helps not only high flyers in our schools, but it helps folks who maybe didn't envision themselves as college material. They can try a CIS course in the high school, get used to the rigor that they would face in college, and maybe imagine some possibilities for themselves that they didn't think of before. That's very exciting. The language in this bill to include data reporting by student subgroup would help us ensure that these programs are reaching and benefiting all students. So that's a particular aspect of the bill we're excited about. I'll stop there, but we're happy to have this opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 995.
Thank you. Mr. Brown.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members. My name's Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And given the time and the wonderful testimony you've already heard, I'll just be very brief and say thank you to Senator Claussen for authoring the bill. And we just see it as a logical extension of the committee's efforts to build bridges for students between high schools and post-secondary education.
When we get to mine, I'll give you the
just
link.
Two quick mentions. Would like to highlight Section 6 of the A3 amendment today. I think that's a great addition. And we'd also like to highlight the change in Section 3 of the bill that eliminates the participation limit for students that aren't on track. We think that's also a very valuable addition as well. So thank you very much, and we ask that you could support Senate File 995.
Thank you. Mr. Nathan. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be less than 60 seconds. I want to thank Senator Claussen and the other testifiers. We've talked about these issues for 30 years. I want to ask you to take a look at this yellow piece of paper, which has just been distributed, and the side specifically that refers to the MDE state four-year graduation requirements. There is a great deal of discussion about closing the achievement gap. What happens in this state when youngsters who are African-American take dual credit, specifically concurrent enrollment or PSEO? You can see there's a 30-point increase. There's almost a 39-point increase for some groups. For every single group in the state, there is a significant increase of at least 10 points. This is the kind of thing that is supported by research. This is the kind of thing that has been promoted and helped by a variety of groups, and I salute Senator Claussen and other groups that have come together to produce this bill. Thank you. Thank you. We'll have time for a couple of questions, Senator Peterson and Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nathan, actually, you're probably the perfect person to answer this question. I've been a longtime supporter of concurrent enrollment and PSEO and all of the other options that are available to earn college credit. And I don't think the answer to this question necessarily means that they're not a good thing. That's not what I'm suggesting. But, however, you're probably familiar with some of the comments or thoughts that Dr. Kent Pickell has made around concurrent enrollment, particularly the statistics that you're outlining here with regard to the fact that students that happen to take concurrent enrollment graduate at a higher rate, and therefore that's sort of justification for using it with more people. Do you know of any studies, however, that have controlled for the type of student? In other words, it would stand to reason that an above-average student within a cohort would actually take a concurrent enrollment class, and then so therefore it's not exactly there's not exactly a legitimate control that's factored into that analysis. You understand what I'm saying? I'm sure you're familiar with the comments in that regard. If you could speak to that just real quick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, two brief comments. First of all, on the other side of the piece of paper that I just alluded to are a series of studies, a Texas study of low-income youngsters that found that low-income youngsters, most of them first in the family, were 2.5 times more likely. That was an apples-to-apples comparison. There are other studies. I refer you to the Teachers College Columbia,
report. Males, low-income, and lower-achieving high school students all appear to benefit from participation to a greater extent than their dual-enrollment peers who enter college courses with more socioeconomic and educational advantages. So that those are two of many studies that could be cited. Secondly, over the last 3 years, with the help of various foundations, we can make this one page available to you. We work with youngsters in area learning centers, youngsters with whom traditional schools have not succeeded, and they have been enormously successful. We have produced 384% increases in dual enrollment participation, and 80% plus of those youngsters have been successful. So this is a tribute to teachers who encourage, assist, and with all due respect to Dr. Paquel's point of view, one of the central points that he makes is that teachers can have a huge impact on motivation. This is a great example of teachers encouraging, as you heard from some of the students, teachers encouraging youngsters to do more than they thought possible. So motivation can be promoted. It isn't simply a matter of the quote-unquote easiest students taking this. So I think this is a great example of progress that's been made. And one of the things that I think is important that Senator Claussen has said is we want to make sure that this information gets out to a variety of people so that youngsters from low-income families, youngsters from first generation, and youngsters who have not succeeded in traditional schools can also take up, also have these opportunities.
Senator,
do we have that person? Hand, that one-pager that Mr. Nathan has in our packets?
The yellow one.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
No.
We don't have that one, right? Okay.
It was also in the, I referenced in that packet. You should
it
have.
It should be in the packet.
Of that. So. But Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Quick.
One of the things that we didn't talk about and that I was very impressed with at the Academy of Peace was there's an entry point program that prepares students for college in the schools through the University of Minnesota. And that was, I think, a great program that maybe addresses what Senator Peterson was asking, because there is a program that prepares students to get ready to take college in the schools program courses.
Senator Kiffmeyer and Senator Pratt, then we're going to have this move to Finance Committee.
Okay.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so what I'm noticing here on this list of testifiers is exclusively from what I can see the University of Minnesota. And just to preface it, I do support these. I just want to be sure that everyone is doing what we are expecting them to do. That is, in the statute right now, you have NACEP, but you also have an alternative method. I didn't hear about that today in the statute. So I know it's not just the University of Minnesota. And, you know, when everything I've heard about what the U of M does and how they do it, you know, the site visits and a lot of these things are exemplary. And I've heard good things about that. But my concern is we also have MinSCU, we have others that are doing this type of program. And I haven't heard anything here today that talks about how do they do it and is it the same as the University of Minnesota. So maybe Senator Claussen, there's information. I have gone through my packet. But I've only seen the U of M. I have not seen other systems that do this program.
Senator Claussen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, in particular, the Buffalo Public Schools are in a relationship with the St. Cloud Institution, and so they could speak to that. But part of your concern I tried to address in the amendments, where the requirement that they must belong to the National Council, so there is an overseeing party that's looking at it, also the Advisory Council that was in the amendment, also the follow-up studies that are required. So I share some of your concerns because this is a program that's out there with dozens of higher ed institutions, and providing consistency is important. I think we have an excellent model at the University of Minnesota College and the schools, and we want to try to duplicate that, and part of that is through the amendments that are in Senate File 995 to try to address those concerns.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Kiffmeyer.
I would have been nice, though, to have had them here today. Maybe in Senator Bonoff's committee we'll have a greater opportunity, but I bring it up as an issue to help stimulate that in the next hearing. Thank you.
Okay, members, if we will go till about 10:45 or so, and then if we're with the assumption we're going to complete this in the next few minutes, but then we'll meet at 6 o'clock tonight if we have to go to the remaining bill, Senate File 990. And again, this has another stop through finance. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, could I just have Principal Mischke address Senator Kiffmeyer's concerns, because their school does have relationship with St. Cloud.
Very briefly, this will have another hearing.
Okay, I'll be really quick. Just highlight on the green sheet of paper. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not addressing you first. But on this green sheet of paper I handed out earlier, Senator Kiffmeyer, it references the other schools that we have connections with, St. Cloud State, Southwest State. And in terms of the Minsky system, we are also in a process of working with a comprehensive plan with North Hennepin Community College. That will be an oversight for all of our course options through the three existing universities, and also a comprehensive plan to fill the gaps where students need. So we have three other universities I could speak to if you would like to know more about our relationship with them offline. And the success we've had. So,
Mr. Chairman, we'll be glad to speak with the principal offline, separate from the committee.
Great. No, thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And like many of the proposals, there are works in progress. We thank everyone for their great testimony. And we will look forward to continued discussion as we put together our respective bills. Senator Claussen moves that Senate File 995 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you very much, Senator Claussen, for your work and to all the testifiers that were here. Next will be Senate File 990.
Senator Wieger, would you please rush to the table?
I will. We're going to do it right here, actually.
No.
Sandy.
Senator Wieger with Senate File 990.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 990 is about providing relevant, meaningful, helpful information to students, to parents, to teachers, to the community regarding progress that's being made in one's educational journey. I have learned about a group, the Data Quality Campaign, when I was at a meeting of the Education Commission of States. I represent our state. I replaced Senator Jen Olson, who worked really hard on that commission. And I learned about this national organization, and they rate states in terms of various indicators on, you know, information in a survey that they do. And then I learned about what Minnesota's doing for its information that's made available. And what I'd like to do is to call first on the executive director of the Data Quality Campaign, who can highlight what this is about and then specifics in the bill as to the types of information that would be available. The bottom line, most importantly, is for our goal for college career readiness, what is the information that's going to be helpful, meaningful to students and others as we track the progress that's being made. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Amy Rockstad-Gadira, the Executive Director of the Data Quality Campaign. It's a national group, and she lives here in Minnesota. Actually flew, though, in today from Washington to be with us. So,
Ms. Gadira,
thank you.
Welcome.
So much. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Chairman Wieger, for inviting me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back. And as the Senator said, I am an unabashed lover of data and unabashed believer in the power of data to transform education. And I'm here not just with my hat on as the leader of a national nonprofit advocacy organization that believes that we will never reach our goals of having every child in this country be prepared for success in college and career without better harnessing the power of data, but equally important, if not more important, I'm here as a Minnesota taxpayer, as a Minnesota voter, and most importantly, as a Minnesota mom of two children in schools here in Minnesota. And I'm here to tell you, I need better information coming out of the state, out of the district, out of my schools to help me be a better advocate for my children's education. I need it to be a better voter, to be engaged in the political process, and I need it to be a more informed citizen. And so I really do encourage you all to consider Senate Bill 990, because I think the efforts that are put forward in this bill that have, has been introduced by Senator Wieger really start to change the conversation in this state from one of collecting information for compliance purposes, for purposes because someone's telling you have to do it, to truly turning that data into actionable information that's useful to people and empowers policymakers like yourself about making sure we're having the policies in place that are supporting our goals of having every child prepared for success in our knowledge economy, but also that are being used to personalize learning, helping teachers do their jobs to make sure they're meeting the needs of every child, and helping students themselves own their own data and take a responsibility for their progress through the education system. Just real briefly, you know, Minnesota, many of you have heard me say this before, Minnesota has one of the oldest, most robust, and most rich longitudinal data systems in this country. When we launched the data quality campaign in 2005, only three states had statewide longitudinal data systems. Our state was one of those. And yet where Minnesota has been falling behind is in taking that information, that data, turning it into valuable information, and most importantly, getting it back into the hands of people in this state who need it. Those moms, those dads, those students, the teachers, policymakers, district administrators, people that are working to ensure that every child in this state are prepared for success. And we have an opportunity right now, and this bill represents a great step forward in that. But let me just highlight a couple examples. One, in this bill, it talks about identifiable student information, and it's really important when we talk about information about individual kids that we also talk about the incredible need to make sure that we're safeguarding this data, that we're keeping this information confidential, secure, and safe. And I brought lots of materials on that, and there are links in the materials I gave you to talk further and happy in questions and answers to discuss what's happening across this country that we can learn from here in Minnesota to make sure that we are in the lead of making sure that our children's information is being kept safe and secure. But in addition, there's this, only 17 states at this point are able to provide information about individual kids to teachers and to students. And that's just not right. Part of the reason I would posit that we're having this backlash right now against testing and about assessments is because we haven't been giving teachers and parents the information that they need, so they're not getting any value in it. And in fact, they're not even seeing it. So when you start thinking about it, it's a natural backlash of, well, why should we give more tests or better tests because I haven't gotten anything out of the tests we've already been getting. This bill represents an opportunity to say, wait a second, we need to ask our parents, ask our teachers, what is it you need to do your jobs better? And then this state needs to ensure that we are getting those most vital stakeholders the information that they need so they can do their jobs better. This bill starts to change that conversation from the state's role of data collector to information provider and meeting the needs of the citizens of this state, which is incredibly important. Another piece of this is the public reporting. And Minnesota has made progress. The Minnesota report card is getting there. But when you look at the some of the links I gave you about public reporting, we're not on the list in Minnesota of best in class. We've been doing lots of advisory groups, as the senator said, asking experts in the field about who's doing this really well. A lot of our Midwestern friends are doing a much better job at this than we do. We can look to Illinois, where they did massive amounts of focus groups asking parents and citizens, what is it you want? And then the state led a multi-year effort to get the citizens of Illinois what they wanted. We can do that here in Minnesota, and it's really, really valuable that we do that. Another great example of where we've made progress, but there's an opportunity to change the conversation, is our high school feedback report. The Data Quality Campaign recognized Minnesota's high school feedback report as being one of the most quality ones in the country, and yet, again, it's sitting on a website at a state level. There's no effort to get it into the hands of the people who need it. And there are wonderful examples across the country of where that conversation's changed. It's not a, yeah, we did the analysis. It's sitting over there. You have to know where to go find it. And instead, thinking about how do we make sure that people have the right information in the right format at the right time to answer their questions. That's the opportunity that's different in this idea of a student data backpack, is that it changes the ownership of the data, and it makes the teacher, and it makes the parent and the student the one that is in charge of what's going on. And there's greater transparency about what's being collected, how it's being used, who has access to it, why they have access to it. And changes the portability piece of it. We'll talk about how do we also make sure information is working for kids. But also, it just changes the conversation and provides greater transparency, greater trust, and greater usefulness of this information. Bottom line, there is a lot of work to be done, but there's also a lot of wonderful examples that we can learn from across the country. And I would argue that all of the real leadership that's been exhibited here in Minnesota to change this conversation about adding greater value and really leveraging the power of the data comes to a head in this discussion about access, appropriate access to quality information. And I encourage you all to really consider the goals of this bill and changing the conversation from collecting data to making sure people have access to it, they know what to do with it, so that they can make better decisions for their families and for the students in their classroom. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gujera. Senator Uyghur.
Yes, Will. Ms. Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287, and I'd like to say I was elated when I saw the introduction of Senate File 990, and part of that elation was because we believe the concept of a data backpack can be a game changer for all students in the state of Minnesota, but especially those students who are part of the achievement gap. We have, in District 287, been a key partner in a collaboration between Hennepin County County Commissioners and Hennepin County Superintendents to raise the graduation rates in Hennepin County. And one of the key barriers we have identified is the lack of data portability. And so over the last several months, we have had several technology directors working to find a technological solution to sharing data, and I am pleased to introduce the Director of Technology and Innovation for our district, Chad Maxa, who's been a key leader in that work and has a deep knowledge of how we can do this, not in the future, but right now. So I'd like to introduce it and turn it over to Chad Maxa.
And Mr. Massa, is it M-A-S-S-A or?
M-A-X-A, Maxa.
Okay, Maxa. Thank you, Mr. Maxa.
Good morning, everybody, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for this opportunity. My name is Chad Maxa, and as Sandy mentioned, I'm the Executive Director of Technology and Innovation in 287. The subject of Senate File 990 is the culmination of many years of work and the technology advances that make this possible, and this can have a real impact on student success and can, frankly, be a huge game changer. I'm also excited about the innovation and the potential efficiencies for school districts and our education system as a whole. Statewide, thousands of students change schools within any given school year, and currently when students move between districts, their information does not always follow them. In the absence of good and consistent student information, we will teach what has already been learned in some cases. Students will lose credits that they've previously earned, and they may be placed in situations where they do not have the requisite knowledge and skills to be successful. Fortunately, there is a solution to this problem, and as Amy has already mentioned, there is the solution is a secure virtual student data backpack, which ensures that the students and their information stay together no matter how many times they move from school to school or district to district. Other states and countries are pursuing similar initiatives to tackle the same problems that we're talking about here today. Massachusetts, Washington, Utah, and even Australia are models for this system. This work is critical to the success of students in Minnesota, especially our highly mobile and at-risk students. They often have to start over every time they move from district to district, and in some cases even school to school. These are the students we're talking about when we talk about the achievement gap in the state of Minnesota. By ensuring that the student and his or her information travel together from district to district, we will not only benefit students, but districts will also realize significant efficiencies in their reporting obligations. This initiative is one of the most cost-effective and impactful investments we could make in our educational system, one that provides direct benefit to all students, school districts, and the system itself. I've provided several handouts for your reference. One you'll find with information regarding the Student Data Backpack project that we've been working on for quite some time, and the other is a description of how this system could streamline state reporting. In closing, I'd like to say that the potential benefits to adopting this model are tremendous, and that is why we've seen tremendous support from technology leadership and directors throughout the state. Mr. Chairman and members, I ask for your support as well. We strongly support the bill SF-990, and we also have some recommendations on some of the language that we'll follow up with Senator Uyghur's office immediately after. And I also wanted to mention, as Sandy opened with, the work that has occurred in Hennepin County has culminated in a final report with a number of initiatives and options that we've just completed, and we'll also share that as well along with our recommendations for the language. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. Senator Wieger?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I know time is very limited right now, and there's work that still needs to be done. Obviously, there would be a fiscal note. I wanted to ask the Department of Education if they could just put a statement on the record. You know, there's a directive to the department. Our longitudinal data system is, you know, through that silo of the Office of Higher Education actually works with it. You know that. But, you know, we're asking to liberate, you know, some of this information to a backpack that's student user-friendly.
Senator Claussen has a question. Do you want to have it now, Senator Claussen, or you wait till we have
I can wait till the testimony.
Okay. Ms. Wayne.
Still morning. Good morning, Chair Johnson and Senator Wieger. Thank you. My name is Wayne Nguyen. I'm with the Department of Education, and I just wanted to speak to the SLEDS data system that is included in this bill. The SLEDS data system, as it currently exists, I do not think would have the capability of doing what the bill would want it to do. It's more of a backwards-looking system, and we don't track individual students. So we don't track Jimmy. We track students like Jimmy and kind of that group and kind of how the group moves through systems. And the system currently is built for education, higher education, and DEED. So it's really of a tracking of these student groups through systems. It's not tracking of a student within one certain, K-12 system or just the higher education system. It really is built as a longitudinal system. So I think we would need to work with Senator Wieger to really kind of identify what the SLED systems can do and what it cannot do.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could just ask Ms. Godera for a response. She looked at SLEDs, you know, throughout America. You know, they're being done, as an expert, with thoughts on the response.
Ms. Godera.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and Senator Wieger. And we're happy to work with the department. I've worked with the department here in Minnesota for 10 years now on giving informal advice and ideas, and with Senator Peterson in many roles about how do we truly leverage the system. But by definition, a longitudinal data system means you follow individual students over time, which means you have the ability to take that information here in Minnesota, as does every single state in this country now, to follow it and to combine that information. That doesn't mean there's one way of doing this. I can give you multitude of ways of how states have done this. In Georgia, they've created a system called the tunnel, that what they said is we don't need parents and teachers to hear from the state of Georgia. We know that they're going to go to their local website, their local school website, and that teachers and parents are going to go through that local district rather than through the state. And so what the state has done is put all of the information that the state has through tunnel, literally, so that everything comes up combined with all the information at the local level. And so you have this incredible, rich picture of what's happening, that when a teacher walks in, when she gets her roster in August, she knows the entire longitudinal history of what's happening with this child. And what we've heard in Georgia is those teachers don't have to wait until November to figure out, this kid can't read, or this kid was not showing up to school. They're able to stop focusing the first quarter of the year on diagnosis and start focusing on teacher and intervening and helping kids. We have that potential here in Minnesota. There's not one way to do it. This backpack idea has happened in Utah. It's been done successfully. But there are many ways of doing this, and I think it's an appropriate time to work with the department to find out. But as a citizen, what I'll say is, if this system isn't able to provide information to people like me and to you in your official roles and to me as a mom, then this system isn't working. And there's been a lot of money federally as well as state money put into this system. It needs to work for the citizens of this state.
Thank you. Senator Claussen and Senator Peterson and then Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to put on my principal hat here from days gone by and have gone through many CUNE folders, as there go, cumulative record folders, and we had guidelines of what was to be placed in those folders. From time to time, we would have parents that would challenge that and say, I want this removed from my child's file. I'm just wondering, I've looked through this quickly. I don't see any provisions for that. Maybe you could comment on that, please.
Dawson.
Ms. Cordero.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
So I think that's one of the conversations to have, and I think this is also a discussion we're having across this country right now about the role of parents and parental access and the rights of parents, which is an important discussion to have. And I think one that we're seeing right now across this country, there have been 120 pieces of legislation introduced this legislative session across the country around the issue of data education, student data privacy and security, and many of them dealing with this exact issue of parent access to information and rights to change it. FERPA, you know, the federal law right now, absolutely gives the right to parents to do that, to review and seek changes. So I would see that nothing would change if this information is provided through a backpack or through a portal or anyway. In fact, it makes it easier for parents to have it, and I think it changes the entire conversation when it takes the boogeyman out of things, when parents can see the information on a constant basis rather than having to go FOIA it or get a request or doing it. And it also changes the role of the parent to be one of partner and advocate rather mm-hmm. than one of adversary. That answered
thank
your question,
you.
Sir. So,
no. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Cordero. It's great to see you again. I do see on line 2.34, just to Senator Clausen's point, there is, with regard to the Student Record Center, it says may, upon parental authorization, allow an authorized local education agency to do, you know, a bunch of different things. Ms. Nguyen, you had mentioned that SLEDS doesn't have the capability to identify an individual. But I'm not, number one, is that what you said? And number two, I'm not sure that that's correct. I think there's actually is an individual identifying number for the SLED system. So if you could just clarify that.
Chair Johnson and Senator Peterson, I'm actually going to dial a friend here, our data analytics director at MDE, who can speak a little bit more to the actual system.
You'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kara Arsamendia. I'm the supervisor of the data analytics team at the Department of Education. I'm also the MDE co-coordinator for the SLEDS project. That is, we use personally identifying information to link the system. So we use the first name, last name, date of birth, and the MARS number to link to post-secondary and then workforce information. We do that outside of the P20 warehouse. So we do that outside of SLEDS. That's the warehouse where we keep the data. Once the data is linked, that personally identifying information is stripped from the file, and then it is put into the SLEDS system. So all of the data that currently exists in SLEDS does not have any personally identifiable information attached to it. So there is no way to re-identify individual students that are currently in SLEDS.
Senator Peterson, and then Senator Bonhoff has a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But then that would stand a reason then that going forward, if you change the input, the mechanism that you input that information, the current system could work. It's just that right now we're stripping down the personally identifying stuff before we put it into the database. So going forward, we could simply make that change as a matter of policy or departmental rule. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. There's some other things you might want to consider. For example, SLEDS, there's always lag time in when we load the data into SLEDS. So there's language in the bill that talks about real-time data, getting things to be responsive. SLEDS is usually 6 to 12 months behind the most current data that the department has, which is also something maybe to consider. It's not the most current system because, as Assistant Commissioner Nguyen was saying, it's a look across time. It's a look longitudinally and a look back as well.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that was clarifying, but I know that we have worked with the Office of Higher Ed to give us our, I think it's Get Ready report, Get Credit, Get Ready report, and that does give us a great deal of information about the individuals and their accomplishments. And so I will need to now understand from Office of Higher Ed how they're able to do that report if the data is stripped. That doesn't make sense to me. But in addition, you know, I served on a statewide task force at least 4 years ago, where we were doing common course numbers, doing all sorts of changes for this very reason, because we wanted to make sure that all the data we were collecting was going to be able to impact teaching and learning on a real-time basis. So if, in fact, as we built this out and used the federal dollars, that somehow we haven't harnessed that ability, then I think we've really missed the boat. And the other thing I would say is that we know that best practices around the country right now are pointing to the importance of individualized learning plans and using technology to leverage that. And this is all consistent with what technology avails us, that now we do have a new frontier and ability to leverage technology to impact teaching and learning. So thank you, Senator Wieger, for revealing this break. And thank you for your work, Ms. Gadara. And I'm just strongly urge that we move in this direction.
Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, I also would like to say I'm very supportive of this effort. I think it's a really big effort, and I really appreciate your bringing it forward, because I think it's very important that we try to increase the value of the data that we have for students and teachers and parents. And I commend you for bringing it forward, and I appreciate all this information about the data quality plan. And I would be very interested in seeing the Hennepin County report to see what you've done as a pilot. One thing I wanted to bring up is that districts are, as Senator Bonhoeff mentioned, moving towards individualized learning plans, and some districts, I think, are there are various stages of that. Bloomington is very aggressively working towards implementing an individualized learning plan. And I guess one concern I'd have is, how do we go about making that data, if it's possible to make the data more transferable, how do we do it in a way that doesn't negatively impact the districts who have already put a lot of effort into this, so that we're looking at how to make things interoperable without having them have to do a lot of rework. I mean, it's been a lot of years that they put into coming up with this, and they're making it a highlight of the world's best workforce plan that students will have an individualized view of their data as they go forward, go through the school years. And I'd love to see that transferable to other districts if people move and so on. But I'm just concerned about the technical aspects of how do we create interoperability without really causing a lot of extra work for districts.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that the various parties advocating for some change look at some of the practical and technical considerations, privacy issues, et cetera, and I think there's a willingness to do that, and we'll see what we might be able to report back in 3 weeks or so. I do know, and I hadn't had much of a response on this until just recently, but it's been positive with some questions. But what I'd like to do is to move it for recommendation to pass, that it go to finance, but where there will be a fiscal note, but that we wouldn't bring it up unless we had something that was reasonably worked out, and various stakeholders have indicated an interest, and we would notice people if they wanted to participate in that in the meantime.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, but let me say that I know you have addressed the privacy issues, but again, I think that one is going to, for me, I will have to have a little more assurance or find out the protections that are out there. It's just, again, for the future. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say to Senator Wieger, I would hope we would hear the finance element in this division as well, outside of the, I know it may go to the finance, the full finance committee, but I would hope we would hear the financial provision in this committee.
Yes, technically, Madam Chair and Senator, we're in the policy right now, but it would go to finance just to be kicked back to the division again.
Okay.
And so it would be fully vetted.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Wigger?
If you'd like me to speak to our final report for Hennepin County.
Very briefly.
Sure.
I could?
Yes.
In our final report, we estimate, and we worked with a number of stakeholders with an MD and Minute at MD to develop these numbers, but we anticipated about $3.5 million year one and $1.5 million each year after, just to get a sense for what we're talking about in terms of budget scope.
Thank you. And members, thank you for your consideration. I want to thank Ms. Gadara again and for their national effort and the fact that you live here in Minnesota and with your Parent Act as well. And we need to take advantage of that. There's a commitment to work together with various stakeholders. We'll do that. And that said, I would move that Senate File 990 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance.
Any questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you. And members, our next meeting is Monday. It won't be Tuesday. It'll be Monday at 8 a.m. And on the back side, you'll see what we have listed. And we are in the process of contacting authors for a number of other bills. We're not meeting Tuesday in the morning because Finance has our room. We will meet from 4 to 8 on Tuesday if we have to. And at the last meeting, I had indicated that we hope to pass our policy bill on the 19th of March. We'll roll that out during that week in the same process that we've used in the past and sharing it and posting and looking at amendments. So,
okay. If that's it, meeting adjourned.
Thank you.